Welcome to the Vegan Connection podcast. Today's guests are the owners of Monk's Meats, Rebecca Lopez House and Chris Kim. Chris shares how he went from being a corporate attorney to creating the first vegan barbecue business in New York City.
Hello and welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for both being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
I would love to know what came first. Did the business idea for Monk's Meats come first, or did your diet into vegan and vegetarianism come first?
I stopped eating meat in 1996. So
yeah, same for me.
Definitely came like the change in diet and habits came first. Had several careers before we started the company. And we actually started the company in a large part because I was working in Manhattan in Midtown. I was commuting to work on a bike and I was bringing my food from home, and my coworkers thought I was some sort of space alien in my Midtown office. And
what were you doing in the Midtown office?
I was a lawyer for 10 years.
Get out of here. I would never have expected that. I love these stories. That's what this podcast is about. Okay, please, you have to just give us a little bit of backstory.
Okay, right. So I practiced law for about 10 years.
What kind of law?
I started in music entertainment contracts.
That's interesting.
And which was what I went to law school for, what I thought I was going to do. And after a few years of doing that, I realized that, one, it was a really bad time in the early mid-2000s to become a music lawyer or to do anything in the music industry.
Yeah.
Because the entire economics of the music industry was falling apart. But I also figured out that actually, how do I say this diplomatically? Although it's a serious practice, it is more of a vanity project for lawyers to be entertainment lawyers in music than it is a serious moneymaker. So almost all of the lawyers that I met who were successful had come from corporate practice with a pile of money and paid off law school loans and several pieces of real estate they bought, which were subsidizing their hobby of being a music lawyer.
It's not like becoming a real estate attorney, right?
Yeah. I mean, let's put it, another way to put it is this. As a starting out music lawyer, coming out of first year of law school, my friends who were public defenders were making more than me and I was envious of them.
Wow. So, that's like, you know, that's them paying their dues even if they want to go into private practice, whatever. Yeah, wow.
Well, you pay your dues in music too, but there's like tons of people who want to do it. So the industry... surprise, surprise, the music industry takes advantage of people's desires. Yeah, so I did that for a few years. Yeah. I left that first to do real estate practice, and then eventually just went deeper for the money and went and did corporate litigation, which was very, 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 very far from my heart and soul. So I was like sort of like a space alien. I would show up in Midtown, you know, on my bike, change my shirt in the elevator, unpack my, you know, food from home, all of which was like, you know, like plant-based and healthy.
And everyone's like, what are you eating? Where do you get your protein from?
Right? Oh my God. Yeah. So much of that too. And like these guys would be like, oh, I just went to the gym and I just lifted so many weights. And like, now I've got to have a chicken salad. Like, cause you know, you need protein. And I'd be like, okay. I'm doing triathlon this weekend. And like, they'd be like, oh, no way. How could you do that? And
meanwhile, your recovery time was much better. Right?
Yeah. I'm sure I literally rode my bike into work every day. Like I was like super active and all these guys were like, kind of like complaining about their cholesterol and the heart medication, even though they go to the gym all the time, they're like getting prescribed heart medication. And, you know, everyone was like, you know, basically showed up at work in the morning and like, the topic of conversation was what kind of takeout to get until lunchtime. And then they'd order takeout. And then the afternoon conversation would be about how crappy they felt after their, you know, meat heavy paleo protein like lunch.
Following then, whatever trend of the moment, right? Whatever.
Yeah. So I would come home from that job and I had definitely had a lot of entrepreneurial ideas kicking around. But I would come home and be complaining about my coworkers and how short-sighted they were and how like just like full of propaganda, sold on propaganda they were, of all kinds of different types of propaganda. And Becca was like, well, I am really tired of hearing you come home and complain about this every single day. You should maybe do something about it. And so I was trying to start a couple different like a media company and like do different things. And we were, you know, like we actually met over an entrepreneurial idea that wasn't this idea.
Yeah.
But we bonded over like cooking and shooting the shit. And so then, you know, this kind of like came out of a dinner and it was a kind of a joke, but it also like seemed really like a great way to be like low-key activist about promoting plant-based diet, vegan ethics, you know, environmentalism, you know, and like for me, one of the big turnoffs to capital B V veganism was the constant proselytizing from some people and the sort of militancy. And so I definitely was looking for a way to promote the ethics, promote the health benefits, promote the environmental benefits without preaching to people. So this seemed like a great way to like low key do it. And, you know, like not that we're trying to trick people into eating plant-based, but to provide them with options and to show them that there was a way to like do this and not starve to death and not feel like you are missing out on good eating experiences and stuff like that.
Which is probably the reason why you don't have vegan in the name, right?
We are now Monk's Vegan Smokehouse. So
you
we
are.
Do yeah. have vegan in the name, but we did initially call ourselves Monk's Meats, thinking that we were super clever and that we were not going to use M&M. The word vegan mm-hmm. in the name or in any of our marketing because it was going to be a turnoff for people.
But that also, like the whole Monk's Meats thing, I just want to interject for a second because I think this story is funny and it also goes to like an origin of, you know, where that came from, what we were thinking. But when I had a friend that lived in California and we went out for dim sum with her father. And, you know,
she was Chinese American, by the way.
She was Chinese American. And her dad, you know, she was telling her dad, well, she's vegan, you know, she doesn't eat any meat. Like, you got to get stuff that's like, you know, good for her or whatnot. And he just called the waitress over and was like, bring me Monk's Meats. Bring me Monk's Meats, all the Monk's Meats stuff. And that to the waitress, like she came over with a cart that was like specifically like everything was plant-based, vegetarian, because there was definitely in that community people that were Zen Buddhists that didn't eat meat or anything. So when we were thinking of names, we were going back and forth and it was like, well, there's this story and that's where Monk's Meats came from.
That's originally. Great. I think it's really interesting that you came, you know, you worked really hard in school and were, you know, following what you probably perceived as a pretty straight and narrow path filled with security, right? Like you probably thought like, okay, I'll have a good job, I'll have a career, like, you know. And then once you're there, you're in this environment, it's kind of like you're there, you're doing the in the box thing of going to school and following this path. But while you're there, you're saying, I did all this and now it's not for me. Is
yeah,
that how you kind of
I mean,
felt?
I knew I was like a square peg very, very early on, actually. So when I graduated from college, I moved to New York and I had a like series of unconventional jobs. And I kind of like, you know, I was a bike messenger. I worked in restaurants. I worked in coffee shops. I was a tutor. I did like everything except a straight and narrow job. And I sort of was convinced / pressured / dared to go to law school by people, you know, like my family, my ex-wife, were all kind of in this place where they were like, oh, well, you're so smart. You should do this. Like, you should do something more than like all these crazy jobs that you have. And then I had some friends who were like going to law school or planning on going to law school. And they were like kind of like a little pretentious about it. And I like kind of had this like ego about like being able to like, oh, if you could do that, I could do that twice as well kind of attitude about it, even though I always knew I was kind of an outlaw anyway. And so I did go to law school knowing kind of that most of it wasn't for me, but I had some ideas that I'd figure out a way to make it work. And after, you know, a few years of like trying to figure out a way to make it work, I did realize that it was just not going to work. and there were some really basic things about it too, besides the fact that like politically it wasn't like a really good match for me. I also realized like after a few years of sitting at a desk that like that wasn't really the kind of work that I wanted to do either. And, you know, like there were, my dad's Korean. My mom's got like a PhD and several other degrees. Like education was really big in my house, and everybody's like, oh, you got to do this kind of like intellectual, like kind of work.
You felt the pressure.
Yeah, but then I realized after a few years of working in like big Midtown law firms that like it, you know, they're just intellectual sweatshops. They're not really like...
They're not happy.
Yeah, well, and it's not even like they're like really... There's like a lot of mythology about legal practice, about professional, like being these professional professions in American society. But like really, they're kind of like, they don't do very much of anything. And I had this like real sense of wanting to be more productive. And I did feel that like, and I'm sure my lawyer friends will probably like jump down my throat about this, but I felt like being a lawyer was destructive, not constructive.
That's your truth though. And you should by all means own your truth and vocalize your truth.
And I definitely, what I was specifically doing in Midtown, working at a big law firm, defending people whose ethics were extremely questionable and their economic practices were, to me, borderline like war crimes. You know, like some of the things that like, people were doing, you know, like, and like we did a lot of, like I did so much stuff with like securitized mortgage-backed securities and like all these like, you know, these things that were like a train wreck. Yeah,
right?
It was like 2008. And there were like
2008. Yeah, I can only imagine what you saw.
So like 2008, 2010, I like was like working in these Midtown law firms, and I really was like, this is like a highly destructive profession. And even like, yeah, blah, 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 everybody needs representation. You know, like the adversarial system is like how people get justice in our society. There are all these things, all these myths that they had about it. But ultimately, like I did a lot of covering people's tracks after they stole from America. And
oh my goodness.
Like, and I won't pull my punches about it at all. Like, I think that what they do in a lot of these Midtown firms is protect the most destructive elements, most manipulative, exploitative elements in American society from the consequences of what they, you know, of what their actions are. And then they get paid really well for it. So they parrot a line about how, you know, free markets and capitalism and justice and all this other garbage.
I think that in a corporate world, to be someone that thinks outside the box like you do, right? I think that it eventually had to wear on you, the ethics and the morals and the day-to-day activity that you were doing and servicing your clients or the clients of the firm. It seems like it was doing an injustice to you and to your happiness. And it seems like that's what it helped pivot you into Monk's, what became Monk's Meats or Monk's
absolutely.
Vegan Meats, right?
Yeah.
And what I love about that is to have that mind frame in the 90s to say, hey, I'm not going to eat meat anymore.
Well, it's a couple of things. One is there's a lot of information out there now, but, you know, like with the environmental issues and, you know, like a lot of the ethical issues with consuming animals, like that information was out there. You know, like, I mean, when was Silent Spring published? Like in 1971 or something, 68?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Like there's
it
so
just
much,
wasn't in the forefront.
Yeah,
it wasn't easy to find.
Yeah,
and
there
we
was
didn't
so
have
much
Google.
Information out there. But
yeah.
as a high school student, you know, I was very aware of you know, global warming, climate change, you know, like I stopped eating fast food in 1989, specifically because of rainforest deforestation, because there was huge information campaigns about Burger King and McDonald's and how they were they were the cause of deforestation in the Amazon to produce beef. In 1989, this information was out there.
But you have people to be willing to be open-minded. There are that watch the documentaries that we all know and appreciate and don't go vegan or I don't care.
It's fake news.
Yeah, or they say whatever.
I don't believe in that science.
Exactly. Yeah. People have to be willing to be open-minded. And it's, and food is an addiction. Like dairy is addictive. Meat is addictive. There's a lot of reasons. I won't get into all of the reasons why that could be a whole other podcast. But so when you say to people, no, they're like, what do you mean? Because they just had meat a few hours ago and that's their addiction.
You know, and when it comes down to it, that's why there's so much like animosity towards vegans and vegetarians. Like you cannot go to a dinner with 10 people who are like, you know, like omnivorous, like traditional, and like obviously you go with 10 vegans, but you cannot go to a mixed dinner with 10 people and not have two people like attack you.
Forget it. And if there's a nutritionist at the table,
forget it.
Yeah, what do you mean? They think you're crazy because you don't eat eggs.
And it's like a huge battle, and you'd be like, whoa. All I did was say I wanted to order some French fries and salad.
Yeah, I'm not telling you how to eat.
I didn't say anything about it. I didn't even mention that I don't eat meat to the table, but you noticed that I wasn't eating meat and all of a sudden it's become this topic of conversation. And aggressively. And so then you're like, oh, so yeah. Then you're like, and I'm like, I didn't go to law school for nothing. Like I definitely have never not been willing to respond to an attack. You spend a lot of time having to hone your message because people feel guilty about what they do. And that's why they attack you. They feel judged just by the simple fact that you made a choice that they didn't, because food is such a fundamental, essentially like food, clothing, shelter, essentials of life.
Yeah.
So people feel very attacked and judged when you make a different choice than they think is the norm.
And it's a lifestyle choice. It's something some people do 3+ times a day, right? Eat.
I hope most people do.
Or at least juice or
a
something.
A little bit of something.
The aggression part is the reason why I personally was never very preachy. And the way I grew up being a vegetarian and then transitioning to being vegan, I definitely grew up the mentality of, hey, I'm going to come to dinner or I'm going to eat what I want to eat. You guys eat whatever Thanksgiving, holidays, whatever. Just as long as my food is vegan, I'm not going to come out and preach to you. But when we started the Instagram, we wanted there to be a level of activism without preaching. So to us, yes, I eat salads almost every day, but I'm not posting that. We're posting the more indulgent food.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is that's what people are going to be the most excited about to eat. And it's almost like there's levels of veganism where, most people start out by being a junk food, not all, but most people start out by being more junk food vegan or trying to look for all of the alternative meats and needing to have that in every single meal. And then there's levels where you're like, hey, I can eat a variety of plant-based foods and every meal doesn't have to necessarily have, I can have monk's meats for lunch and then for dinner have steamed vegetables and
yeah.
And so forth.
That actually touches on one of the reasons for our creating the company in the first place too. It's because like 10 years ago, we haven't been quite around for like 10 years, but 10 years ago, the vegan food scene was very heavily steeped in like all your favorite fast foods, like veganizing them. And
it still is.
But much, much more so. So like, 10, 15 years ago, it was like, what can I get that's like a fast food thing turned into a vegan thing?
Yeah.
And like, I'm all about it.
Yeah.
And then like there's been like, because before that there was like a whole wave of vegan food that like, and this is where like we came to this wanting to put food first and then put the ethics and everything else like sort of like as a precondition. It wasn't the like reason for the company. We're just like, that's a given where it's all plant-based.
We're vegan. It's
all
given. Vegan. And then
you know?
The food.
And then, but really what's important to us is that it's great food, you know? And we felt like when we started the company, there was a lot of fast food. There was a lot of comfort food that was being veganized. Vegan foods had sort of had this reputation from the 60s and 70s and 80s of the sort of like Angelica's Kitchen, Moosewood brown rice, Moosewood cookbook, like steamed vegetables, like
tofu cubes,
lots of hummus. Yeah. You know,
I'll take the hummus.
And I mean, well, look, like I love all of those things.
I'm teasing you.
I love all of those things. But like it had this like sort of like no spice, no flavor. Everything's brown.
It was
soft.
A lot of people perceive as rabbit food.
Yeah. And hippie food or whatever. And then so there was this whole like period of like veganizing junk food and then veganizing comfort foods. And when we started the company, there weren't really a lot of places that were trying to do like really food forward vegan food. Like most of the people who were doing vegan food at the time seemed to have come to it from being vegan first and then, oh yeah, and I want to make some food, you know, kind of attitude. And we definitely came to it with an idea of being foodies first. And then
that's how we are.
And wanting to bring the, you know, the like,
it just happens to be
vegan.
Yeah,
it happens to be vegan.
That's amazing. And I love that because you're not trying to veganize a specific dish. You're just trying to make or dish or sandwich. You are just trying to make really great food that happens to be plant-based.
Right. So like now we've been doing this like barbecue thing for a couple years, really hardcore. You know, obviously we still make all the different vegan meats, but our ready to eat business has really focused on barbecue.
Which is amazing.
And thank you.
Really, it is.
And the reason, like kind of like the path to like becoming a barbecue business, really it actually goes through a lot of people that we know who are meat eaters and mm-hmm. meat makers. And who got really, you know, in the, you know, around 2008, 2010, when we were starting 2012, when we were starting the business, there were a lot of people who were like obsessed with whole hog barbecue and with like butchery and with like, you know, just like even our backyard barbecues that we're going to, our friends were throwing, were like coming up in a level and becoming more serious about barbecue. And, you know, it's just been this huge barbecue renaissance going on. And so as, you know, as a Midwesterner, I grew up with a lot of barbecue and I wanted to bring plant-based to the barbecue basically.
And there really isn't a lot. I mean, unless you're going to put barbecue sauce on something yourself or you're doing, you know, barbecue vegan chicken or something like that, there really isn't
a lot of, and that the thing was a lot of the vegan barbecue dishes were some like tofu or tempeh or something with barbecue sauce.
Exactly. That's what
and if you are in, if you are like kind of paying attention to the barbecue world, like barbecue has nothing to do with barbecue sauce. Barbecue sauce is like the afterthought.
But not to vegans,
right? The flavor that they get is just the barbecue sauce
flavor.
And I
love barbecue sauce.
And I mean, I make killer barbecue. I make six killer barbecue sauces, but like of different kinds. But like in the end, or in the beginning, it's all about smoke and salt and heat and time. And it's not, the barbecue sauce is a finish, not the beginning.
It's not the base.
It's not the start to finish. It's like just the finish. So like there, we brought a lot more process behind the scenes to doing barbecue. Like we, you know, everything what we serve on Saturday started in our kitchen on Tuesday at the latest, if not earlier. And all of it, like it's, you know, we make all of our vegan meats and then we like let them sit, we rest them, and then we do a rub and we let them age and then we smoke them and then we serve them. So like there's a lot of process
behind it.
It's
a labor of love.
But that's where, you know, we've been able to like connect with people in the barbecue world because we understand their process, the process of doing barbecue. and they see the process behind what we're doing, so that even when, you know, like barbecue guys, like real barbecue, like hardcore barbecue guys come to like my booth at Smorgasburg and they talk to us and see what we're doing, they're like, oh shit, this is like real barbecue. This isn't just some like fake vegan barbecue.
Yeah, that where you just throw on some barbecue sauce and call it a barbecue. And it's what you're doing is the full barbecue process from start to finish and completely paying barbecue the respect that it deserves and also bringing the flavor through appropriately. I would love to see you guys enter into some barbecue competition, like the way like a lot of like the fried chicken enters regular competitions.
Yeah, we did a an event a couple summers ago that was a barbecue and blues event. It was a music festival and it was all barbecue outfits and it was pretty intense. The one thing about that that it showed me was we need to get our barbecue rig like game up.
Yeah, we need to have
those barbecue
like a
rigs were insane. Like we were definitely, we were overwhelmed by the number of people that we saw that day and the like Pig Beach rig was like a small trailer, like U-Haul trailer size smoker. It was gigantic. It was like the walk-in at our commercial kitchen is like about the size of their smoker.
Yeah, so we had like, our little tiny van. And our
little tiny hippie Volkswagen van pulled up and we like, you know, roll out our
little smokers.
Brooklyn barrel smokers. And it was eye-opening how big the barbecue game is out there. Definitely aspire to be there.
I think the main thing too that it's been showing us is that there's always in every market and every food scene, there's a place for disruption. And I think that that's something that we've been doing over the last couple of years is we have been disrupting this barbecue thing. We've been showing stuff that people will come and say, these mushrooms were amazing. I ate like everything here and this was the best sandwich I had. And
I'm sure
just doing something that's different and showing people that there is a different possibility out there and then giving them something that it like stands up to what their expectation is. Or maybe their expectation was lower because it was plant-based, it was mushrooms, then to have their socks knocked off by it. That to me is like building a fan, building a person that will come back again and again and not care that it's plant-based.
What you guys have down packed is not just the flavor, but it's the texture. And that to a meat eater or to a vegan, when the texture is right, on especially on seitan, it's just phenomenal. I don't know how much other seitan you get to eat, but there's a lot of bad out there.
I stopped eating meat in 96. I've had a lot of seitan.
I'm sure.
I mean, like these days, a lot of the reason.
I think we only eat our seitan,
yeah,
really.
We do
which we probably
own.
Should eat other ones just
I,
for market
I do,
research.
I
mean,
I
guess when we go out and stuff, we eat other stuff, but.
I would love to know more about just like, if you can just bring us through, I guess, a timeline of from when you started to you had a place in Brooklyn, right? You that closed and now you're only at Smorgasburg and you are just now starting to, so you're going to be at a new location, but you're also selling wholesale, correct?
So we started the business in our kitchen.
Okay.
Over dinner.
Yeah, I love that.
Becca is actually the first person in our team to try making seitan. And it came out really well. And then we were like kind of joking about it and like about what we could do with it. And it kind of like snowballed into an idea. And we literally emailed Smorgasburg like maybe that night, maybe that week. But like we emailed them like pretty much right away.
Full excitement.
Full of excitement. And they got back to us. Like almost right away, like which is unheard of from them too. And they were like, tell us more. Tell us about your, do you have your paperwork? Like, what do you, and we were like,
paperwork?
Oh, so yeah, paperwork. Insurance, like, permits, license, company. We'll get right back to you. So we went back to the drawing board. We like told them, all right, cool. We're going to like get all that stuff, look into that, get together. Took us about 6 months, I would say. In the meantime, we started doing some pop-ups. But really the reason why we started the business in the first place was we thought it was going to be a grocery brand. So if people remember
solely wholesale?
We thought retail. We were going to sell retail at grocery stores and we have Packet. We had it packed. We had it at Perlandra was one of our first customers. Those guys in Brooklyn Heights are great. It's super, super cool, old school.
Health food store that continues to offer awesome things.
Fantastic. And they were one of our first accounts. We had all the usual suspects around town of the sort of hippie friendly, healthy grocery stores.
You mean hippie in the most loving and endearing way.
I am totally hippie. Oh, absolutely. Sure. We're definitely.
We always one of the other random hashtags we use, which is kind of just a joke between us, is we'll hashtag things like the hippie black magic. Cause sometimes things
when
will
things happen.
And we'll just be I don't know, is that hippie black magic?
When that barbecue sandwich tastes that good, it's just that hippie black magic. I love that. Yep.
So we started out as a grocery brand and we were doing some pop-ups just to market our brand. And we got back to Smorgasburg. We did a tasting with them. They were really into it. We started selling at Smorgasburg. And initially that was actually a marketing exercise for us to build our brand so that we could sell more stuff at the grocery store. And we were growing the grocery store business pretty steadily, but it was we grow 300% over a winter and we realized that our sales grew 300% and our expenses grew 310%.
Oh boy.
So we were realizing that the more we were making, the more money we were actually losing. On that game, and that maybe we needed to do a little bit more research, go back to the drawing board. We realized that we probably needed a substantial amount more money to really do that well and to get out there.
Sure, yeah. Production alone.
Just production, but really marketing.
Yeah.
In-store marketing is the most expensive and it's the hardest thing to do. Anyway, so we started doing that. And we kind of were realizing we're losing money and we were making money selling food at Smorgasburg and at pop-up markets. And so we started getting really in. We're really into that anyway. We like to feed people. So, we're making cool sandwiches and doing all kinds of stuff. And so we did that for a couple years. We kind of walked away from the grocery business, but we started doing wholesale to restaurants and caterers and stuff. And the margins were a little slimmer, but everything was so much easier that we were actually making more money on what looked like a slimmer margin.
Okay.
On that. But the biggest thing was still selling food at Smorgasburg and whatever. So then we took a lease on a store in Bed-Stuy, which we still have a lease on. But we had some... typical Brooklyn, New York real estate issues. We got in, we started doing our permits, which the permit process is much, much...
it's the worst part.
It's a much bigger lift than I realized it was going to be. I anticipated it was going to be. And then we started doing demo and then we opened up the walls and we found things, as always is the case.
Yeah.
And including joists that were cracked. Oof. And things that there were things that were rotten and things that were leaking from our neighbor's store into our store. And so we went back to the landlord and this isn't really our problem. And they were like, great, this is not your problem. Don't worry about it. It'll take us 6 to 8 weeks to fix it.
Oh, okay.
We'll take care of it.
Good then. Yeah.
6 to 8 weeks turned into 3 months, turned into 6 months, turned into 9 months. 11 months later, they give us the green light. At that point, we were super stalled on a lot of issues.
Were you paying rent that whole time?
No, we weren't.
Okay.
But then when they came back to us, they wanted us to pay rent.
What?
And we were you just had us on hold for a year. And now we're having, on our side, we redrew the whole space. We changed our sort of focus of what we want the space to do. We're back to square one with permits. And by the way, we're sort of short an investor or two because of the year-long layoff that we had. People got a little antsy.
Yeah. Which is natural.
So,
it's not your fault. It's not in your control.
So we're in a place now where we're on hold. We're sort of in negotiation with the landlord because there were additional issues that came up and they want us to pay rent and we want us to not pay rent. And this is typical
New York real estate stuff. BS. Yeah.
But, we also spent 2 years working on that space. you know, trying to fundraise for it and keeping the business going and
we
passing
also put
up.
A fair amount of money into that
yeah.
space too.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's
that was the other thing that's super frustrating is like we had a very successful Kickstarter campaign. We had a lot of people, you know, excited about that space and that space took like a lot of that from the beginning. And then it's like, now we're
stalled.
We're so stalled. So we're
trying to figure out what's going on. We're still, long story short, we're still trying to figure out what exactly is happening
with
that space. Whether we're still in it, whether we're going to walk away from it. Like, honestly, it's sort of up in the air. But in the meantime, we've decided that we really needed to move forward with the rest of our business because
good.
We are just like going to…
There's a demand.
Yeah. And there's just like… It was like we're spinning our wheels and getting frustrated and it was just like… It was like a blockage. So we were like, we have to figure out a way around it. And for me, always, and for us, I think always, the way around blockage is work. But if you are banging your head against the wall, that work's not productive. So we were like, okay, let's see… what the hippie black magic can bring us.
Yes.
We put it out there that we were interested in moving to a new kitchen because we've also had on the other side of things, like the way if you don't have a restaurant or a storefront, like the way food works is you have these like commissary kitchens that people work in as like new companies or as like a lot of wholesale production sounds companies.
Tough.
Like, you know, you work out of these commissary kitchens where there could be 10, 15, 30, 150. In the case of Pilot Works, there were like 180 companies all working
wow.
in one kitchen. And we'd had some setbacks. So like with that as well. So we'd been in like a kitchen that we liked. We moved because it was too far away and they moved to a smaller space. And we moved to this like bigger, fancier, nice, fantastic .com-y kitchen called Pilot Works at the Pfizer building. And that turned out to be too good to be true
aww.
Because they kind of abruptly pulled some shady .com shit and closed the doors, locked everybody out and peaced out because
yeah.
they ran out of money. So we were like looking for kitchen space and we've been like sort
the
of
irony,
vagabonding.
You left the corporate world to try and go back to the corporate world.
Yeah, so like we were out like, you know, we've been vagabonding a little bit. We've been in like four different kitchens this year and we put it out there to the universe that, hey, we're looking for a place to like land because we've been in all these different kitchens and our project is sort of stalled. We're not sure what's going to happen. And the Star Bar got back to us.
That's in Bushwick,
right? That's in
yeah.
Bushwick. The Star Bar actually ended up being almost like, you know, like too good to be true.
Oh, I hope not.
Don't say that.
But yeah, no, don't say that. But it ended up being like just like an ideal situation. It's a bar in Bushwick. It's in a nice part of Bushwick. A lot of things are happening there. It's a beautiful space. And it's a space that's dedicated to social justice.
That's great.
So the bar itself has an event space attached to it where they do all kinds of things from North Brooklyn DSA
to comedy nights
to like LGBTQT dance parties.
So you're like, within a community that you are ethically aligned with.
Yeah,
which is
absolutely.
Great.
And then on top of that, they have a sister space called the Mayday Space, which is nearby in Bushwick. That's like community activity center. So they host like classes, workshops, you know, like meetings, all kinds of stuff in that space also. So we really felt like this is like an like just like a great like, you know, like they had this kitchen and this greater social justice message that all of it kind of works with us. And so we're kind of really excited about going in there and bringing our business over there. One, because Bushwick is like a great popping neighborhood that's always been really good to us. But two, because this space is already dedicated to so many things that we believe in.
And know, are so. You guys completely taking over the kitchen? Like all of the food there will be Monk's
yes.
vegan
yeah.
meats?
All
everything will be vegan.
All the food will be vegan. And all of it will be us.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. We're starting with 7 nights a week, 5 to 11. We are shortly going to add delivery and a late night menu. And then at the top of the year, we're planning on adding brunch.
I was just going to ask you about that. That's mm-hmm. awesome. Will you have any new menu items at this new location?
We will have many new menu items and several of our greatest hits that people haven't seen in a year or two because when we started working on the space, we sort of pared our menu a lot to like try to streamline operations. And now that we have a space that we're going to be cooking in 7 days a week, we can bring back some of our favorites.
Anything you can highlight?
Well, we're bringing our Rasta Roots Jerk Seitan sandwich back. That's like our first one that we're bringing back.
That's exciting.
Which is personally one of my favorites.
It's really good.
Yeah, I love making jerk. And then we're also bringing the Hot Hens, which is a Nashville style maitake mushroom dish that we did over the summer. We're bringing that to the bar. And we will be bringing some of the other things that we've done over the years in his specials. So things like our bulgogi seitan sandwich and probably some of our kimchis that I like to make. But the theme is still going to continue to be barbecue. So there's going to be a lot of like, there'll be some new things too that people haven't seen from us.
Yep.
Because we like to do new stuff all the time too.
And that's what people, you know, want to see. They want to have the classics, but they also want to know what else is new. And, yeah. And that makes it more exciting, especially being at a new location. You definitely want to give people the incentive to see what's different from what you would be serving at Smorgasburg. So I love that you're doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like, we're really excited about the brunch menu. We've already been working on the brunch menus.
Any ideas of what you're going to be doing with that?
It's going to be Southern inspired. And we're trying to eschew some of the like more expected brunch things. We're definitely not, I'm gonna go on record right here and say we're definitely not going to do any kind of fake egg thing for brunch.
I wouldn't expect that from you.
And
We'll have a tofu something probably.
We'll have a tofu something. And we would definitely will be bringing some biscuits and gravy, but beyond that, grits. But beyond that, we're going to have some surprises too, kind of working on.
That's very exciting. Wow. Is there anything else that you guys have planned? I mean, this is a really big venture. Are there any other markets or anything that you have planned coming up other than this new venture?
We haven't talked about it yet, but we've been really into going to California in March to do Vegan Street Fair. So we'll probably
love
be looking
Vegan Street
into
Fair.
That.
Yeah,
we had a great time every year that we've done it.
We love Jess and love Vegan.
Jess loves really nice. Fairs. Yeah, we love lots of love, right?
So, yeah. But I think those are the biggest highlights for right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the
those are some big highlights.
They're pretty big.
Yeah.
I think that's also like one of the lessons that we've had with all of this is that you get to a point where less is more. Like people want more, more, more. But for us as producers, like this is an opportunity for us to narrow down our to-do list and to be more focused on like churning out like really high quality stuff. You know, but like a smaller, we're not trying to be all over the place. You know, a few years ago, we did every pop-up that we could get a hold of and we did all these new menus all the time. And it was just exhausting for us.
And you kind of figure out where your place is, your niche, where you really excel.
Yeah. And I mean, and we've kicked off tons of ideas that, you know, we will eventually come back to at some point. But, you know, like there are definitely some things that we're really, really excited about doing.
What piece of advice would you give yourself 10 years ago?
Well, I would definitely tell myself 10 years ago that everything takes longer than you think and costs more. So be ready for that. That's definitely the biggest piece of advice. For every entrepreneur,
yeah. I was going to ask you, and what piece of advice would you give someone starting out in today's vegan market or in any market?
Don't do it.
No, don't say that. It's an uphill battle.
It's an uphill battle. And like you really, I would say for people starting out in the vegan market, just be really
be patient,
but also really refine your product and your craft of your product and just try to bring the best possible thing you can to the market because there is so much stuff on the market now.
And it's not 10 years ago.
You can't just like, you know, throw anything at it. And honestly, and not to be like discouraging of people, but like look at the market, see who's out there and see if there really is a need for your product or not.
Because there is a lot of redundancy.
A lot of redundancy and a lot of people who, you know, like they have big plans, but you know, there's already a lot of people out there who are executing the things that they may think they're doing that are so novel. There are actually a lot of people already executing them pretty well. So make sure you know what else is out there.
I have one more question for you. What advice would you give anyone that's following a path that they think is safe and secure because they are being encouraged by loved ones to take that safe and narrow path, but maybe their heart is and desires are in more of a creative field, or you know, or they have desires to be a chef or to own a business?
Well, I personally think that you can't do anything really well unless you really believe in it. So you can do a lot of things okay, but if you're really going to get the best out of yourself, you have to believe in what you're doing.
100%.
So that you know, I have three kids, right? So my
God bless you guys are so young looking. My goodness.
it's the plant-based diet,
right?
But you know, I have three kids, and I tell my kids all that. My daughter's in high school, and we had this conversation just last week. And I was like, you know, you don't have to go to college if you don't want to. And if you do go to college because you want to, and you're going to get the most out of it that you can, and that you're going to use it to prepare yourself to be the best person that you can be in the next phase, which is like when you're really like out there doing something. Like, and always don't do things because you think you have to or because you think it's expected. Do things because you want to.
Do you feel like intuition plays a big role in that? Do you utilize your intuition?
I mean, I'm.
Or is it just your passion?
Arguably, I'm all intuition.
I didn't want you to be like, I didn't know if you're going to be like, I don't believe in intuition. It's just my passion. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't believe in planning.
But you got to plan.
So I definitely, that has definitely been my like, okay, like, how do I get a support system around me of planners? Because I'm not a planner.
Well, that's important though. That's important. And they say that's the key to a good boss or to any great entrepreneur is knowing what you're good at and knowing what you're not good at to delegate those tasks or those things. That's great. That's probably why you've succeeded as far as you have.
You could ask some of my former sous chefs and they would probably tell you that it was a hard lesson learned.
I'm sure. We all have to learn those hard lessons in life. So, well, thank you both so much for being here. It was an absolute pleasure.
Great. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to the Vegan Connection podcast. Make sure to check out Monk's Meats and The Vegan New Yorker on Instagram.